With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. Is there a better time to enjoy a fresh-cooked meal than spring? So many ingredients are at the peak of their growing seasons, and flavors in full bloom at HelloFresh. Enjoy the taste of spring with chef-crafted recipes featuring ripe seasonal ingredients delivered right to your door. And there's no more scouring the grocery store for that one ingredient you need to complete your recipe, something I know a whole lot about. HelloFresh takes away all that hassle by delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients so you have exactly what you need, and it helps you cut down on food waste. And HelloFresh cares about quality. That's why their seasonal ingredients are picked at peak ripeness and travel from farm to your home in less than 7 days, so you know that they're fresh. As I've told you on the podcast before, I am not a great cook. My wife, my oldest daughter, they can stare into the fridge, see a couple of ingredients, add some spices, and boom, we have a great meal. Me, I need a plan. HelloFresh gives me that plan. They make it easy, that's so easy that I can cook a great dinner. So if you want to join HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/16BA2023. That's code 1616BA2023 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/16BA2023. And remember, HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. You can join the club today. Get HelloFresh. 2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Goal.
Welcome back to the 90th percentile. This is your host, Jeff Ponce, member of the prospect team here at Baseball America. We are finishing up a conversation from last week. We talked a little bit about velocity. We want to get a little bit deeper into the topic today. Maybe some traits that portend the ability for guys to add velocity and just pitching in general. But of course, as always, I have my co-host here with me. That is Matt Pajak of Loaded Sports. Matt, how's it going, man? How's your week been?
Oh, it's just been an absolute treat. Happy to be here.
Same here. I've been I've not been at the ballpark this week, so this has been one of my more unusual weeks where here at the house watching games on TV, doing some number crunching, doing some scout calls, etc., all that other stuff with my job. But I can't wait.
He's got his feet up on the couch.
Yeah, exactly. I'm upstairs, not recording in the dungeon today. So
sounds like you got some Raising Cane's waiting for you.
I do. Yes. They just opened up, I think maybe the second or third Raising Cane location in Massachusetts, about a 2 mile drive from my house. So my wife just surprised me right as we were starting this podcast with some Raising Cane. So I'm committed to the show. So I'm going to finish the conversation here and know that I have some chicken tenders waiting for me. Luckily I've already gotten my workout in this morning. So I'm feeling a little bit.
We'll make like the topic and work fast.
Yeah, exactly. Like we have a pitch clock, you know?
Yeah.
It's very on brand. We got to talk some food first though. I know you got some hot takes you want to come in here with. We were talking internally, this is in the BA chat. We were talking a little bit about different fast food places, the fast food places that we like. Somebody stumped for Jimmy John's, and I, as a quality Northeasterner, was very offended by the pro Jimmy John's talk. So I pinged Matt and was like, I just saw someone put a 60 on Jimmy John's. I don't know if I can stand for this as a true sandwich lover. I'm not even sure that it's top two or three in terms of like sub chains. And I know there's some regional ones, but I would easily take like Jersey Mike's or D'Angelo's above it. And to be honest with you, I get subs all the time and I rarely go to a chain. Like there's enough pizza places and sandwich places around me that there's a lot of options. If I lived a little bit further south in Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, I'd have even more options. So yeah, I don't know, man. I've had Jimmy John's a few times. It is a very subpar sandwich. So
yeah.
So the floor is yours.
We're just full of puns today. Subpar. We're going to talk about Jimmy John's, which is freaky fast on a Velocity episode. Just bring the noise. All right. I'm gonna keep it a buck with you. Growing up in Massachusetts, going to school in Rhode Island, living the first 22 years of my life in that part of the country, I did not realize how sandwich deficient the rest of the country was. It's like a real treat if you're in any other part of the country to find a place that actually makes a good sandwich. So I think that's a good place to start this conversation is that, are we sandwich snobs? Probably, right? But I think we do need to touch on a couple of these that are available all over the country. In true evaluative form, put a 2080 grade on them, right? So yes. Jeff, I'm going to let you go first on each of these.
Oh.
And hopefully, you know, there'll be some surprises in here, whatnot. You know, hopefully we don't get burned at the stake for this, being sandwich snobs from the Northeast. But let's start with the OG sandwich chain, the OG national sandwich chain, I think. I don't know. The Jared Fogle special, Subway.
Oh, I gotta say, I think Subway is a 20. Like, I don't find any roll there. I don't like the bread of any type. When I do go to Subway, I had to eat Subway recently. It was back in March on my way to New York, of all things. It was off the highway in New York. I needed something quick before we went into the city because I knew that we weren't going to eat until probably like 6 o'clock that night. And I was starving. And I there's something about pre-cut deli meat that really bothers me. It could be because of where I grew up. It could also be the fact that I worked in a deli a little bit during college. And it's so simple. Like it makes a big difference. Just like fresh cut meat. Right. That bothers me. And like, I end up getting, this is bad. This is actually a bad choice, but I end up getting the tuna subs at Subway because I like tuna. And like, that's not even like tuna. Like, we don't even know what that is. It's not even like tilapia. It's not even bad fish. It's like non-fish. Yeah. So that's pretty rough. If I have to go for a tuna fish sandwich because I'm not feeling the other options, I think Subway's as bad as it gets.
Yeah, Subway's at the bottom of my scale, 25 for the sandwich chains. You know, as 20, I hear you loud and clear. I used to house Subway, so there's a little bit of nostalgia in there. That's where
five comes from.
Yeah, that's where the five comes from. Their cookies were really good. I used to love the smell of Subway, walking into a Subway, and now I probably wouldn't eat it. I never ate the pre-cut deli meat. I was always an oven roasted chicken guy, but now looking back on it, it's more like an oven roasted sponge. Subway 25, wouldn't touch it. The next one, Jeff, Jersey Michaels.
I'm gonna put a solid five on Jersey Mike's. It's fresh cut. I think their steak and cheeses are pretty good. I do like their Italians, which I think is the sort of goat. That's the thing that you like. It's the hit tool. You kind of judge everything off of the Italian, right? That's my go-to. They got the oil. They put the seasoning on it. You know, they have. Decent meat, you know, cheese, the bread is fine. And there's other variations. Yeah. So I'll get it Mike's way. Exactly. I'll throw the five on that one. That's consistent. You know, maybe it's like your seven or six hitter, but it's fine. It's consistent. I got no problem with that one.
Yeah. We're in the same ballpark on this one too. I went 45 on this. Yeah, of the options, you know, you have the option to get it Michael's way, which is, you got to do that. I like the fact that they've got hot sandwiches there, you know?
Yes.
And not that Subway doesn't, but they've got actual hot sandwiches.
Yeah, they're not microwave. They're made in an actual grill.
Yeah. So kudos to Jersey Mike's. And all right, option three here. All right, I don't know if you've come across this one or not, but I think it is all over the country now. Capriotti's.
I don't think I've had a Capriotti's. Right, so. There's an off chance that maybe I had it once. Like there might have been one for a hot minute at Patriot Place at Gillette, and I might have had it 10 years ago. I feel like it might have been that place and it was fine. But it just seemed like a better Quiznos to me, if I remember correctly. But I could be off. I could be off on this one. So only got a single look. I think it was years ago, if that's Capriati's.
Look, Jeff, I'm going to keep it 100 with you here. Capriati's is a 60.
Oh, okay.
Now hear me out. Capriati's has a sandwich called the Hot Bobby.
Yes.
And it's Thanksgiving on a sandwich.
Yep. I've had this before.
Yep. So it's turkey.
Yes, I have had this place.
Cranberry stuffing. And I had it last night. And I've had it probably like three or four times now. And it's billed as like America's favorite sandwich. I could see it. It's that good. So I haven't like done a deep dive on the menu or anything like that, but you're talking about a really unique sandwich that actually lives up to the name. And it's a 60 for me, which I wasn't really expecting.
Interesting.
But Eric Peterson, AA pitching coach for the Cardinals, put me on to Capriati's back in the fall, and I haven't looked back. So I was skeptical. You know, it's a sandwich chain. You know, it's what we're talking about here. It's like we're not. I was skeptical, and it outplayed what I thought it was going to be. So
now, have you ever had that sandwich at D'Angelo's? Because I used to get that exact like day after Thanksgiving sandwich at D'Angelo's, like pretty consistently, and this is like 20 plus years ago. And I'm also a fan of their number nines, which is the steak and cheese with peppers and onions.
I didn't really have a D'Angelo's close to me growing up, so I didn't have it a ton. I don't really have as much of a reference point there. So that's a blank for me.
Yeah, the Thanksgiving toasted sandwich there is very similar to what you described at Capriati's. It comes with a little dipping container of gravy as well. I don't know if Capriati's should add or not.
Yeah, no gravy.
Yeah, I don't know, man. You may need to try a D'Angelo's Thanksgiving toasted when you're back here in New England again. I'm a D'Angelo's guy. Like I would probably put a 55 on D'Angelo's. I'm reluctant to throw a 6 on any sandwich chain, but I am more pro D'Angelo's. Part of that is my own nostalgia, because that's where we would go and get subs my entire life, because there was one like right next to my house. We didn't have a Subway till many years later. So that's my go-to. And then there's a bunch of other sandwiches in like Philly and New York that are like one-off spots that
if it's a black spot on my resume that I put a 60 on Capriati's, I can live with that.
Okay, fair enough. You know?
But I think last one here, all right, and this one probably runs the gamut depending on who you talk to. All right, we're gonna talk about, this is the one that started the whole conversation.
Yes.
James Jonathan's, Jimmy John's, Freaky Fast. Jeff, what do you got?
I'm putting a 30 on it. Like, I always feel like there's not enough stuff on the sandwich. Like, it's slightly an upgrade from Subway. The bread's probably a little bit better. But if I remember, like, there weren't a ton of options I was all that thrilled with. And it just, you know, it's just not, I'm not in. I'm just not in at all.
I think 30 is spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked to some people who put 60s on it. I've talked to some people
who've
gone higher than that. There's some people that are comfortably around 50, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, I don't get it. What's the appeal of Jimmy John's? You know what I mean? I think the bread's fine, but it's not like, look, I would rather go to the Subway and get a loaf of the Italian urban cheese bread. You know, I'd rather have that than Jimmy John's bread. I don't know. Jimmy John's.
And the funny 30, thing is, Jimmy John's,
it shouldn't be open.
I don't like the Italian. It's a bad sign if the thing that I'm going for at any sandwich place is a BLT sub. But I feel like when I've had Jimmy John's, that's been my go-to, is just the BLT sub, because you can't really mess that up. It's lettuce, it's tomato, it's bacon with some mayo on it, and it's fine.
Yeah, Jimmy John's is bad. I don't mean to like slam on Jimmy John's by any means, but it's borderline non-edible. you know, and I think we should probably get into the actual topic of this
podcast here. We've been 10 minutes on this now.
But before we do, I just want to let everyone know, and I want to make sure that I'm crystal clear, black and white on this, that Jimmy John's is not good.
And hey, you can like whatever you like. It's your taste buds. It's not mine. But from a couple of sandwich snobs, some sandwich elitists from the Northeast, this is our opinion. All right.
Right. If you like Jimmy John's, if you like Jimmy John's, I'm gonna just give you side eyes, and we'll keep it at that. We'll keep it safe.
We're gonna keep it moving. Yeah. Let's get into the topic though, because I think this is an interesting one, and I think it expands on what we had previously discussed, and that is there is a level of athleticism that if you're looking to add velocity, and with a lot of guys that do add velocity, that it sort of portends that, right? That like guys who are athletic, I think a good example of this is like a Nick Frasso. It's easy to see a guy like that can potentially get up to 100 miles per hour at peak. You see some other guys like this every year in the draft where it's like, all right, like, I don't know if the skill's there, I don't know if he's going to throw a ton of strikes, but there's absolutely, you know, an ability there to add strength or add, you know, pitch velocity. It's not just arm speed, just because of how efficient that person moves. So you are probably as well versed in this topic as anybody. So I'll sort of give you the floor on this one. But what are the sort of things that you look at when you're evaluating players and their athleticism, because that's what your job is, that sort of tell you like this guy could potentially, like, this could be a, you know, he's 92 now, 93. This guy could be 96 plus. Like, what is it that you sort of see?
Yeah, and I don't think there's any absolutes on this topic, but I think it really opens the door to speaking on like what actually is a projection arm. And projection arm is something that's thrown around a whole lot more with high school guys than college guys. But Frasso is kind of an example of a college projection arm, right? Where Frasso, 6'3", 6'4", 180 pounds, really athletic, 91 and 93 in college. I think he started, you know, pumping some 5s, 6s, 7s during his draft spring. Maybe some of that strength was coming on, but then he went into pro ball and he added 20 pounds. And when he added 20 pounds, now he's, you know, comfortably sitting in the high 90s. And I think it's that athleticism, right? So I think there's a couple different things that a pitcher can tap into in terms of trying to find that velocity. Once they get into pro ball, I think athleticism is kind of a leading indicator for an evaluator on whether an arm actually is a projection arm or not, right? I think we see a ton of, especially on the high school side, like 6'6" to 6'2", 175, 180 pound, you know, right-handed pitchers, left-handed pitchers, whatever, low 90s. And yeah, they're all labeled projection arms, but I don't think they should all be treated equally. I think the guy who's 6'2", 180 and athletic is a projection arm more so than the guy who's 6'2", 180 pounds and maybe not athletic. So I think that's why it's important. And Jeff, this kind of, you know, I'm going to dig a little bit deeper down and we're going to go into the amateur ranks a little bit, right? So anybody that's listening, you know, who knows any high school pitchers or youth pitchers or whatever it is, like something that I was around the game for a while at that level. And everywhere I went, if a guy was a PO, like he wanted to be treated like a PO, and he, you know, he made it a point to say like, oh, I'm not an athlete, I'm a pitcher, you know? And I think that's a huge misconception, but I think that's like a very widely held thought for whatever reason, is that, oh, the non-athletes go and pitch. Well, at the highest levels of the game, the best starting pitchers are athletes,
yeah.
Right? So I guess the message is if you're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old and you're a PO, that's not just like a one-way ticket to go sit in the bullpen and eat seeds while everything else is going on and then pitch. It's go be an athlete and prove your athleticism. Cause if you want to play this game for a longer period of time, like athleticism is going to carry you to higher levels of the game from an actual projection standpoint. So, I don't know, Jeff, like from, you know, we talked about Frasso being an example of an actual like college projection arm, kind of a rare case. But you know, an example on the high school side, and you know, I'm not going to call out the name by any means, but there was a kid that signed out of Texas, high school kid, a couple of years ago, 6'2", 180 pounds, and like a really poor athlete, and he got a lot of money, and he hasn't, the projection never came because the projection wasn't there. So, yeah, I mean, strength's important, no doubt, but strength added to an athletic frame, projection. Strength added to a non-athletic frame, probably not a whole lot going to happen there. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we see it every year in the draft. One of these – and like, the other thing is velocity at a young age isn't necessarily indicative of future success. We saw a guy, it's been about a decade now, but Tyler Kolek, right? I want to make sure that I get Kolek's first name correct, because there's been a few Koleks, but Kolek, you know, 27 years old now, I think he's retired. Went second overall in the 2014 MLB draft, and I mean, he never advanced beyond a ball, and he threw really hard at the time of the draft, not really all that projectable, and that was kind of it. This is also sort of prior to us having a good understanding of fastball movement and the certain types of shapes at certain velocities that are actually unique. But I think he's sort of a good example of like a guy that people went crazy on because he threw hard really young. And there's these other guys that are better athletes, more projectable, maybe a better fastball shapes, guys that might even end up in college that were 89 to 92, but you move it forward 5 or 6 years and those guys are more 3 to 5, 3 to 6 or whatever, with better shape, with more capabilities and abilities in terms of, you know, locating the baseball and understanding sequencing and all these sort of things. Pitching's hard. It's more than just velocity. I think we said that in the last episode. And I think too often people are like on the polar opposites of the extremes, you know, and not everybody can add velocity either. There's plenty of guys that are pitchability lefties or whatever that sit 89 to 92 and they're good in college and they come into pro ball and they're fine in the lower levels. And then they just never progress beyond that sort of pitchability type. And go and look at, you know, pitchers that are successful in the major leagues, like even guys that are number four starters for like 6-7 years, there's just not that many guys that are these like soft tossing pitchability types without athleticism. You know, you have to be an incredible outlier. I know we use like, you know, Kyle Hendricks as an example, but I even think guys that are up velocity wise from that, like those lower 90s guys, you don't see a lot of those guys either, unless they have like a really special secondary pitch. So who are some other types though, that have added velocity that, you know, maybe some of it came down to like different reasons. Cause it's not always athleticism. There's a variety of different ways that guys sort of get to that point. I know one that you had discussed before the show was Spencer Strider. And you know, Strider obviously is not the biggest guy, but you look at his lower half and he's like incredibly physical. And there were some mechanics changes, you know, once he was coming off of that arm injury at Clemson.
Yeah. Strider, I think, is just an example of a guy who's probably wired a little bit differently. Right. So like that guy kind of set his mind to, I'm going to go reinvent myself. And he went and he did it. Right. So I think if you look at the way that he is set up mechanically now versus how he was set up mechanically at Clemson, it's two completely different pitchers. I think you look at the lower half, it's two completely different lower halves. I mean, it might as well just be a different human being at this point. Right. you know, he's kind of the poster child of drop and drive, which I think, depending on who you talk to, like, it creates that lower release height. And if you have, you know, a lot of induced vertical break, then creates the invisible fastball. And I think that's what he's got working for him. I think that's starting to become popular. So he's kind of a pioneer in that regard. I think Bryce Miller is kind of in that mold, an invisible fastball at the top of the zone, a lot of induced vertical break. So yeah, Strider probably more so of just, you know, a dedication to optimizing his mechanics and figuring out, you know, the best way to work with what he has. And obviously he's Quadzilla. So, I bet he can move some weight.
What one would think for sure. Yeah. And it's interesting. Cause like you brought up a guy like Bryce Miller, where like one of the things that when I first watched Bryce Miller at Texas A&M, and this is a guy who's, you know, a, whatever, fourth year players, you know, potential senior sign, you know, I think probably gets drafted, I don't know, in the teens in terms of like rounds in 2020, if we have a full draft, ends up back at school, you know, still wasn't, you know, whatever, top 100 players and draft on any lists. He was a great mover. Like the way that he moves in the mound, his ability to, you know, get downhill, he's not a super small guy, and create like outlier release traits. And I think that's what you see with a lot of these guys that have these sort of flat VAA fastballs, is they're guys that get downhill well. There's a lot of balance within the, you know, the operation. I think that's something that gets kind of like ignored a little bit, is like how balanced guys are, like how you know, well sequenced their bodies are in terms of like where their arm is when their, you know, their plant foot hits the ground, and just how well they repeat. That's a huge part of pitching, and being able to land your pitches, but also repeat shapes and, you know, like all that sort of stuff. And Miller's always had that. Like that's one of the things, like the first time I watched Bryce Miller, it was very easy to see that he got into good positions. And it's one of the reasons that as soon as he got into that Seattle system, within like 6 months, he was popping a hundreds, which is not something that he was doing, as far as I know, at least the best of my knowledge, at Texas A&M. And he's held that. He's held velocity with great shape. I mean, he gets as much, you know, induced vertical break as anybody in the big leagues. And he does it from a really unique slot. And he wouldn't be able to do all those things if he wasn't a good mover. And, you know, I think the guys that we see that have a lot of success, Max Scherzer is a really good mover. You know, I'm not sure that like Verlander's a crazy mover, but like Verlander like is very efficient in his lower half, and like how sequenced up he is, how well he repeats. And it's one of the reasons that Verlander has had velocity dating back to when he first broke into the big leagues and when he was in college, and he's now 40 years old and is still, you know, pitching fairly well in the big league level. I think we see that, right? And a lot of that is athleticism. I mean, are there athletes that maybe don't repeat all that well, you know, because they're like, you know, sort of like hyper movement patterns, almost like a Cody Bellinger is like a hitter, guys right. That are so freaky, like that they move so well at times, like they lack a certain level of stiffness that maybe is good in baseball. And I think you see that with swings and you see that with mechanics. But then there's other guys, like one of the names that we brought up ahead of time is like Chris Sale. And Sale is like a very unusual, unique mover. And I think it happened eventually, but it took like 8 years of everybody being like, this guy's going to break, this guy's going to break, for him to finally break. And he had, you know, pretty close to a Hall of Fame career prior to that actually happening. So there's different ways that guys move too. And I guess, like, I know this is kind of putting you in the spot, but when you look at a guy like Chris Sale and how that guy moves, what's unusual about him versus other guys that he can make that work? and generate the velocity that he does. Because there's not a lot of lefties at that slot that have ever been guys that have at any point in their life been able to touch 100 miles per hour, and Sale at his peak could do that.
Well, I think, you know, just from the eye test, you're probably looking at some combination of athleticism and it's just the levers being as long as they are, right? So I think that's a huge part of this conversation is like, where does velocity come from, right? And there's some things that are within your control, and then there's some things that are just not within your control, right? And I think that's why you talk about like, okay, this guy's a good mover, and this guy might not be a great mover, and this guy's athletic, and this guy's not athletic, and, you know, this guy's got long levers, this guy doesn't have long levers, whatever. So ultimately, when you're looking at athleticism, or when you're looking at velocity, it comes down to athleticism, right? Lower half power output, it comes down to how long your arms are, because it's just basic. I don't even know what you'd say here. Physics, I guess. Think like a windmill. Like, would you want to get hit by a little pinwheel, or would you want to get hit by, you know, one of those really slow moving, you know, windmills or wind turbines out in a field in Arizona, right? Like, you would not want to get hit by that thing. As slow as it's moving, that thing is producing a lot of power.
Yeah.
Just because of how long it is, right? So it's the same thing that we talk about on the hitting side, exit velocity, longer levers. Yeah, probably more swing and miss, but longer levers, probably more exit velocity. So I think that's an important thing to consider here is, you know, if you're looking for like the perfect profile of velocity, it's an athlete that has long levers, that has mass, that has really good movement patterns, right? So I think that's where, like, when we were talking about Spencer Strider before, like, for him, it's just optimizing his movement pattern, right? And that's kind of where his velocity jump came from, I would bet, was that he just became a much more efficient mover. And I think on the topic last week, it was like, let's talk about velocity versus command. And you got people on both sides of the spectrum. And I think, you know, you've probably got people on different sides of the spectrum or quadrants in terms of where velocity comes from. Oh, it's, you know, there's the people that'll die on the hill of, it's all about the, you know, the way that the athlete moves. Yes, that's important, but that's not the only place that velocity comes from, right? And that's where, when you look at lower half power output, I think that's a really, that's the motor of the athlete. I think that's really important. And then obviously there's the God-given frame that you've been handed, right? So like the guy who's 6'2", like there's only so much that he can do with what he's got there, right? But like the guy who's 6'4", 6'5", combine that with a certain level of athleticism, and I think that's probably what you're looking at with Chris Sale, right? And I think going back to like what you said before, like, yeah, two of the freakiest athletes I'd ever tested that were pitchers, you know, I can say one of them, John McMillan at Texas Tech. And you can go look that dude up, and he's been 100 to 102 from the right side for the past 5 years, but it hasn't translated. And I think that comes back to what you're saying about, you know, being able to repeat, right? So it's not all about athleticism, but that's the motor can make the ball come out really fast. So again, that's why it's not just cut and dry, absolute, you know, black and white. There's so many different things that go into this, and that's why there's so many different guys and so many different profiles that have success at a high level throwing hard.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've seen all different types of pitchers. There's guys like a Mitch Keller who, you know, it's taken him a while to get the pitching side of it down, but like I think the thing that everyone saw with Keller from like day one is it's easy velo. Like, you know, he doesn't have to grunt to get to 97 98, you know, anything above that. It's pretty efficient movement, and certain guys are like that. There's just it's easy, you know. And I'm not even sure it's really,
Jeff, sorry. I'm gonna just say this, like, I am in the camp of if the velocity comes easy, that's a great place to start.
Yep.
So that's, I guess, more so than anything, like what I'd advocate for, and talked about it before with the high school guys, like, go be an athlete because there's actual projection there or whatever. I'm not saying that there isn't projection, it's just a whole lot harder to get to more velocity if you don't start with doing it easy, right? So that's the camp that I sit in. You know, anybody can believe what they want to believe and they can say what they want to say. And, you know, some of them are probably right in their own regards, right? But the hill that I'll probably die on is, you know, that athleticism translates to throwing hard and doing it easy. And I'd rather start there than start at grunting and hat falling off and head whack at 90 and try and figure out how to get this guy to throw 96, you know?
Yeah. And I think with those guys, like you just brought up, the head whack guys, the guys that are grunting for it, it's one of those things where it's like, well, in order to get to that, you're doing all these things already and getting out of like good movement patterns or whatever. And maybe physically you're not strong enough. You got to worry about how that projects. Because when you do that, you're going to get hurt. Like, right. You know, it almost pitching in general, pretty high risk that you're going to deal with injury. And then you see guys like that and it's like, all right, like this guy's probably going to end up with an arm or a shoulder injury or even a lower half injury too. Like, you know, so much of pitching is really in your legs. Like there's very few guys like Brusdar Graterol, who's just incredibly strong in his lower half, you know, reliever for the Dodgers, was with the Twins for a bit. There's very few guys like that really have no movement in their lower half, but are able to generate 100 miles per hour, upper 90s consistently. And that's one of those things you just have to be incredibly strong, like just a physical freak, you know. There's just very little movement there and he's able to do it, but there's just not a lot of guys like that. So, I mean, you're talking about some of these college guys that have added velo, like a George Kirby, for example, who was like a command guy, who's not a tremendous athlete. Some of it comes down to just getting like physically stronger and then just being as like efficient with your lower half as you possibly can, you know, so you're getting into stuff and being, you know, maybe like more quad dominant than you had been previously, or, you know, more like glute dominant than you had been previously, like getting into like your, you know, into your actual butt. Like, that's why you see pitchers that have big booties all the time. This podcast is really going off the rails now, but
yeah, we're going off the rails. You want to bring up Jimmy John's again?
Yeah, right. You got to eat Jimmy John's and lift weights, and you would be able to throw hard.
Yeah,
no,
Jimmy John's sucks. Anyway, George Kirby is that's a really good call out. And George Kirby is a guy who's 6'4", long levers, moves really, really well. Probably isn't, you know, the best athlete by any means, but like he's an example of a guy who's having a ton of success at the big league level. But yeah. I do want to throw in there exceptional command and not a ton of swing and miss.
Yeah. I think he's one of those guys that he hits his spots consistently. It's one of the reasons that he's been, you know, as good as he has. And it's fastball command too. I mean, like the secondaries are fine. He throws them for strikes, but you know, looking at like his strike rates and like his in zone rates when he was in the minor leagues, he was somebody that was like near 80% strike rate. And you really don't see that. Even with guys that barely walk anybody, Kirby was like exceptional in that regard. The fact that he was able to add 3 to 4 ticks onto his average fastball and still maintain that command is just like very, very outlier. And it's one of the things that makes him such a unique talent, you know?
Yeah, he's one of those exceptional command guys that, like, if you didn't have that, I don't know who George Kirby would be.
It's a good question, you know? Even if he ticks down a little bit in command, it's definitely not like a mid to like, you know, two, or I don't think he's an ace, but like a number 2 or 3. He's probably more like a 5, like 6, like more of like a depth starter. We see guys like that are like 92 to 93 with some command. They maybe add velocity and then lose a little bit of that command, and then it doesn't work, you know,
right?
Because it's not like his shape is like super exceptional. you know, and it's something we talked about last week, where there's just a lot less margin for error in the zone with guys like this if you're not throwing super hard and don't have Bryce Miller sort of movement profiles, you know. Even if you do throw hard, I think it's one of the reasons that like Hunter Green struggles at times, where like if Green is getting into some of his trouble zones, like his pitch shapes aren't so good and his deception isn't like that wacky, you know, he doesn't hide the ball that well, that he's not going to fool that many guys. So he needs to be at that upper end of velocity in order for all of this to function, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, this discussion, the previous discussion for the people listening, if you didn't listen to part one, go check out part one. The bottom line on velocity and how it contributes, and, you know, talking about the command and all, the whole topic can just put you in a blender.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think there were some times probably in this conversation, sometimes in the last conversation, where it's like, if your head's spinning a little bit, like, you're not alone. Right. Yeah. But I think, again, that's the beauty of it. And that's why that like scouts are really, really good at what they do.
Yep.
And that's why there's always opportunities in the draft in round 4, round 5, round 8, round 9, round 15, whatever it might be, you know, and that's why guys go, you know, the indie ball route, they get signed out of indie ball and then they debut in the big leagues and all that. There's so many different moving parts that go into having success. And it's not like, hey, that guy checks box A, B, C, D, boom, first rounder, boom, second rounder, boom, third rounder. And then like, yep, all their trajectories went right as planned. And if anything, pitching is, it's probably right up there with evaluating a quarterback in football is one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah.
So
because really there's underlying
there. Go ahead.
There's underlying traits that are like difficult to evaluate, right? There's some makeup stuff there, some work ethic stuff there, some physical things, and it's not on the stat sheet. Like, I feel like with hitting, you know, if a guy can hit velocity, you know, if he can hit spin, you know, if he chases or not, you know, what the contact's like, you can figure out how hard he hits the ball. Where with pitching, you can have all of these elements, like, you know, in sort of neat boxes, like he throws strikes and he's got this and he's got that. And this, you know, pitch movement is good and he throws hard enough and he's got three secondaries, he's got feel for, but then the guy gets hit because he doesn't hide the ball. Like, it's very easy to track the ball out of his hands. Hitters are all over it. He's tipping something off. There's so many small things that you need to be good at in pitching to make it all work. That you can look at two guys at 18 years old with very similar stuff and have them physical, you know, bodies, everything could be exactly the same. And then you can go in just wildly different directions just based on little things here and there in terms of what works. So yeah, I agree. I feel like even within this conversation, I get myself into a blender at times where it's like, yeah, but this and that, like there's so many moving parts with pitching. I guess that's another pun, but it's difficult to just be even like 60% accurate with it sometimes. And the other part of it is like pitching, like with, you know, injuries, like we don't know what guys are dealing with sometimes, or, you know, how some of these injuries impact how their bodies even move and the things that they can do 3-4 years down the line, which is a totally different conversation, but, you know, it takes its toll, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know, I'm sure this won't be the last time that we talk about velocity, because it's, you know, such a large part of the game and it kind of weaves its way into a number of different conversations. But, you know, kind of wrap on my end, it's like there's no absolutes. Number one thing for me, bet on athleticism. And again, Jimmy Johns isn't good.
On that note, we'll wrap this up. It's been another episode of the 90th percentile. I'm Jeff Ponce. He's Matt Pajak. You guys are listening. Thanks for tuning in.